Case for argument this morning is 21-2184 Novozymes North America v. Danisco. Mr. Cushion, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. There were two errors the Board made that compel reversal in this case. The first is that it found anticipation under Novozymes' construction, even though there was no evidence that the liquefied mesh formed in the first step of the 179 two-step process. The Board recognized this had to happen because the proteases are dead before the second step of this process, and it's an explicit claim requirement that the protease treat the liquefied mesh. So the Board handpicked a set of conditions it thought would thread this needle. It said performing 179's first step at 65 degrees with certain grains would completely gelatinize the slurry, and that would render the starch in the slurry, quote, susceptible to liquefaction by the alpha amylase. That's in Appendix 49. But being susceptible to liquefaction doesn't prove that the liquefied mesh formed. The Board tried to gloss over that evidentiary fact by saying there was no question that the BATS alpha amylase, that's the only alpha amylase described in 179, was active at 65 degrees. There's two problems with that. That's not the right question. The question is, was it active enough to produce the liquefied mesh? And the second error is that it is wrong. It was definitely disputed at trial whether the BATS alpha amylase would produce the liquefied mesh. That was also a dispute that Danisco lost. It was a factual dispute. Our expert explained that BATS is barely active at 65 and will not break down enough of the starch to produce the liquefied mesh. Their expert, Dr. Clark, came up and tried to dispute that. His testimony was basically, here are these different enzymes. They were not the BATS enzyme. That testimony that he offered was thoroughly discredited in cross-examination.
And did the Board then rely on that?
No.
Where are we in the Board opinion? What did the Board say?
So if you look at the Board decision, that's at 49, Appendix 49. All it says about whether there will be sufficient liquefaction is that the protease was susceptible to liquefaction. It doesn't make a finding that the enzyme, BATS enzyme, actually did hydrolyze enough of that starch to produce a liquefied mesh. And that's why there's an error here. There's a gap. They found that the starch would be fully gelatinized, but gelatinization doesn't produce a liquefied mesh. You have to do the second step, which is break it down with the alpha amylase.
So what are you looking for in this process? Is it a certain temperature, or are you looking for the release of the free amino nitrogen?
It's an interesting, there's two enzymes in play here. One is a protease and one is an alpha amylase. The protease works at a low temperature in the 179 process. That's up to 65 degrees or 70. The alpha amylase works at a high temperature, up at 90 to 95 degrees. So these two enzymes have these optimal activities at those different temperatures. The problem is that at the first step, the alpha amylase isn't active enough. It barely does anything to break down the starch. And that was the factual dispute. Again, their expert tried to counter our expert's testimony about that. We showed why that was wrong, and then it disappeared from the record. That evidence isn't used by Danisco either. Danisco actually distinguishes it in its red brief. They say they don't rely on it. That's at 55. So this creates, as I said, an evidentiary gap.
And Mr. Cushion, one of the concerns I have is, as the Board said, even if it adopted your claim construction, the prior art reference expressly says that it applies a protease to a liquefied mesh. I believe that's even claimed. And I think your argument has to be something like, well, the way liquefied mesh is used in the prior art must be different than the way liquefied mesh is used in the patent itself. So it just seems, you know, given a substantial evidence standard of review, your argument is a bit complicated. And I wanted to know what your response was to that.
Sure. Well, the prior art, obviously, for anticipation, you have to look and see what the prior art teaches, and that goes beyond what words it uses. Now, importantly, in the 179 reference...
But under a substantial evidence standard, why isn't it enough for the board to look at a reference that expressly says, we're going to apply the protease to a liquefied mash and understand it? Why isn't that enough, combined with all the other evidence that was before the board to support its fact-finding? Why isn't that enough?
You have to dig into the dispute that was engaged in this proceeding. We showed that the meaning of the liquefaction step in 179 was different. It was a broader process than the word liquefaction as it was used in our patent.
But it's still with the aid of an amylase and or protease activity.
Correct. I mean, and the problem, again, Your Honor, is that...
That's in the claim.
It's in the claim, but the... 179 reference is when you look at what the different steps are doing, and that's what the subject of the testimony in front of the board was, the alpha amylase was not active enough to break down enough of the starch in that first step. And 179 does describe treating liquefied mash after the second step. Remember, in the 179, there's two steps, low temperature, high temperature, and then they take the temperature down again and do something called saccharification. It's taking me a while to get that pronunciation. The saccharification step is outside the scope of the claim. Our claims explicitly exclude treating the liquefied mash during saccharification. So what you see in the 179 reference is protease treatment before the liquefied mash forms. That's treating the slurry. And you see protease treatment after the liquefied mash forms during saccharification, but our claims explicitly exclude both of those. So there was a mismatch between what is described substantively in the 179 reference and what the claims require. So, as I said,
arguing now that the key distinction for the 179 patent is the fact that it applies protease during saccharification.
It does. When it does treat the liquefied mash, it's at that saccharification step outside the claim. So, as I said, this is an evidentiary gap. They have the burden of proving anticipation. They didn't prove this element that was necessary to find anticipation, and that warrants reversal. There's no evidence in the record to support affirmance on that.
If we were to affirm the board's finding on anticipation, and would that resolve all the issues in the case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
If we affirm the board's anticipation finding, would that resolve all the issues in the case?
No, there are separate deficiencies on the obviousness finding for claims 8 and 9 of the patent. And so even if you did that, you would still have to deal with the errors that were made in claims 8 and 9. But I would first urge you to consider my second error. The second error that justifies a reversal is how the board got to the reading they did of heating to 65 degrees with a certain type of array of options.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
My question is, you seem to be focusing on the anticipation issue, but does your anticipation issue require us to adopt your claim construction or agree with your claim construction?
So that's a great question. What the board did was it found anticipation applying our construction in an attempt to kind of short-circuit a dispute we were having about the meaning.
First, it's disagreed with your claim construction.
Yeah,
right?
Definitely.
We give it the plain and ordinary meaning, and the specification intrinsic evidence says a plain and ordinary meaning means this. And then it said we're not going to require the gelatinization and other elements that you're reading into the claim, right?
That was the board's reasoning, but when you look at what they did to prove anticipation, they used those elements we identified in our claim construction to make out the case. They were trying to, like I said, short-circuit the dispute between whether their ordinary meaning needed to be clarified any further and whether that was needed to use our construction as opposed to that one. One thing they didn't do was use Danisco's construction. I think that's fairly clear. There's no basis for affirmance on Danisco's construction in their decision. So
just to be clear, your view is that the board should have adopted your claim construction?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And the main, and that goes to the reason why you do claim construction is to figure out what the scope of the claim is, and you do that first so that you can assess whether it captures prior art or captures an infringing thing. And the construction they employed doesn't help do that. It misses in some information that was in dispute. So I want to just touch on the problem. The second error that they made was getting this reading or reaching this reading that you would read 179 as a skilled person and see the particular combination that they came up with. That was the predicate of their anticipation finding. It was that combination of barley at 65 degrees with all the other parameters they picked. That's how they got to the foundation of their findings of anticipation. And that was an error. And the problem is, under your court's precedent, there has to be some evidence that the prior art lets the skilled person at once envisage the combination that's being read into the reference. And here there wasn't evidence. In fact, there was contrary evidence. What the board said to justify its reading was one sentence. It's at appendix 50 to 51. And what they said was, 179 is clear that it conflates the combination and mixing in or matching of its separately disclosed materials and processing parameters. All that says, there are a lot of possible combinations for carrying out that first step. Other parts of the record contradict that reading of the board. 179 itself says that its first step should be run between 45 and 55 because that's where the proteases are active. That's at appendix 1024, page 7, 10 to 13. Danisco and its expert in its petition echoed that point. They said, 179 says it can, quote, conduct protease treatment at conditions optimal for the protease. That's at appendix 158 and appendix 945 to 946. Danisco's petition also read 179 is running that first step at 50 degrees. They never mentioned 65 degrees. That's at appendix 141 and 159 to 60. Dr. Cole reached the same conclusion. That's at appendix 2553. And Dr. Cole also explained that 179 teaches that the type of grain in the slurry influences the temperature choice. So, and that's at appendix 2595, paragraph 158. So all this is evidence in front of the board that is contradicting their reading as using 65 degrees with barley. And as your court's recent decision has recognized in Merck, you need something that tells the skilled person that this particular combination is being described. And that's what's missing. Again, this is a second reversible error because this is the predicate of their finding of anticipation. Last point you asked about, I mentioned claims 8 and 9. Just to very briefly point out that claims 8 and 9, on claim 8, what Danisco argued in their petition was that claim 8 was obvious. And they then pointed to, and the claim 8 has a requirement of heating above the initial gelatinization temperature. Danisco said in their petition that to meet that, 179 teaches heating to 90 to 95 degrees. They didn't say heat to 65 degrees. The board's reasoning for claim 8 being obvious was essentially it's almost identical anticipation conclusion. And that's a different rationale, not only in form, but in substance, because the board said 179 tells us to heat to 65 degrees. That's based on that wrong reading of what 165 or 179 is telling you. And I mention this because both of these claims have a process requirement where you have to heat to a certain elevated temperature before you start using the alpha amylase. And undoubtedly, with that sequence, the protease is going to be killed explicitly before you perform.
Unless it's a heat-resistant protease, right?
Pardon?
Unless it's a heat-resistant protease?
Yes, unless it's heat-resistant protease, but that's not what is in 179. I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, the judgment below should be affirmed. In its comprehensive 72-page decision, the Board found that WO179 rendered the claims unpatentable in three separate ways as anticipation under Novozymes' own construction, and obviousness. This decision was supported by substantial evidence every step of the way and clearly correct. I'd like to first address the point my counterpart made about inactive or dead enzymes. As the board found, W0179 discloses repeatedly that liquefied MASH is produced in the presence of and treated by protease. That's in Appendix 42. The board then quoted two full pages of portions of W0179 disclosing those features. And indeed, starting as early as its abstract, on the very first page, W0179 discloses liquefaction of cereal material with the aid of alpha amylase and protease activity to obtain a liquefied MASH exactly as claimed. And based on those disclosures and Dr. Clark's testimony at Appendix 908, 910, his paragraphs 80 to 85, the board cited all of that in finding that W0179 expressly states that its process obtains a sufficient liquefaction and calls the product a liquefied MASH.
Can I ask you, is this analysis that you're referring to at the board, is that based on the board's construction or based on even assuming that your adversary's construction is correct?
That was under both, Your Honor. And the board, in fact, credited Dr. Clark's testimony as more credible than Novozymes' expert's testimony that W0179 is somehow not scientifically correct. I mean, that's kind of the crux of their position, that W0179 isn't disclosing treatment of liquefied MASH, it's disclosing treatment of a slurry. It's just disagreeing with what the reference actually says.
Do you see a difference between liquefied MASH and liquefaction? Liquefaction.
Yeah, well, and W0179 expressly says it obtains sufficient liquefaction, and it calls the product a liquefied MASH, and that's exactly what's claimed. I mean, we're talking about using the same alpha amylase and protease enzymes, and it's in the same alcohol production process and the same
step. But your opponent's arguing on the basis of degrees and heat, and he says that there's a difference. That's the difference between the elements that we're looking at.
Yeah, well, the claim doesn't require any temperature. Claim 1 doesn't require any temperature at all. And in fact, the 409 patent specifies that its preferred temperature for carrying out simultaneous liquefaction and protease treatment is 50 degrees. That's in column 5, and that's the same identical preferred temperature as in W0179. But we don't even have to get into what ifs about protease activity because the proof is in the pudding with the empirical examples of W0179. Example 1 clearly shows that the protease was active. It produced 344% more FAN than the control. And example 4 directly compared the use of the protease during liquefaction compared to in sacrification, which is when Novozymes contends the liquefied MASH is actually present because it's after the higher 90 to 95 degree cooking step.
I believe that Novozymes, I think they argue that the difference there is because for W0179, it's not a heat-resistant protease. What's your response to that?
Well, actually, at Appendix 1019, I believe it's towards the bottom of page 2 of W0179, it actually encourages using preferably thermostable exopeptidases, which is a type of protease. And in fact, in example 4, comparing the treatment of liquefied MASH during liquefaction versus in sacrification, the results showed better performance in liquefaction. And that's empirical evidence confirming, as Dr. Clark explained, that the alpha amylase more than sufficiently broke down the starch into liquefied MASH, releasing the full amount of protein for the protease to treat. As Appendix 1795 is paragraph 109, credited at Appendix 45 and 47. I'd also like to address the claim construction. You didn't really hear much about that in the opening argument, but it's the kind of the necessary first step in Novozymes' case. And starting with the majority and solution requirements, the board correctly determined that these are nowhere to be found in the claims, in the specification, in the file history. The board was correct at Appendix 29, saying the 409 patent does not once use the term majority, doesn't say a solution is required. There's just no disclosure of these requirements at all, much less in any clear lexicography that requires reading them into the claims. And the board further went on and resolved the extrinsic evidence, everything you heard about Dr. Cole. His testimony was rejected in favor of Dr. Clark under Teva v. Sandoz. That's reviewed for substantial evidence in Danisco's favor.
What about the construction of liquefied MASH?
Yeah, that Novozymes had three requirements for that: majority, solution, and a gelatinization step. And so the majority and solution requirements are nowhere in the specification, the claims, or the file history, as the board correctly determined. And that should be the end of the analysis, because a construction that's unsupported by the intrinsic evidence cannot be correct. And then for gelatinization, I'd refer you to the explicit instructions in the specification at column 5 for carrying out the simultaneous embodiment. And it nowhere mentions gelatinization. The temperature depends on the enzymes used. No reason related to gelatinization is mentioned at all. The temperature can be anywhere from 25 to 90 degrees, just as recited in claim 14, and that expressly includes temperatures too low to gelatinize starch. And it also specifies the especially preferred temperature of 50 degrees that is identical to the preferred temperature of the W07179 reference, confirming anticipation. I'd also like to address my counterpart's arguments about the so-called immediately envisage theory. Here, the board relied on W0179 and Dr. Clark's testimony and spent 4 pages at Appendix 47 to 50 walking through how W0179 discloses a cohesive alcohol production process. It has the same steps. It's combined the same way as in Claim 1. And then the board found that for each...
So you're saying that the board said it didn't even have to... this is not a case where the immediately envision or envisage doctrine doesn't come into play?
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. This isn't a case like Lilly v. Zenith, where you have a single generic compound formula that encompasses millions of different chemical compounds. Here, it's a pretty simple question.
I would say the immediately envisaged doctrine doesn't apply there either.
Yeah. I'd say this case is closer to your decision in Purdue, which holds that a disclosure requiring use of a compound, and here this is W0179's liquefaction step, requires conducting liquefaction on a cereal starch. What starches are those? Dr. Clark testified the list of 6 of them. It's a really short list. It's on the immediately preceding page, page 4 of W0179. Cereals in the context of this invention include sorghum, wheat, barley, oat, rice, and corn. And those 2 disclosures are directly linked. Of course, you can't conduct liquefaction on a cereal starch unless you pick one of them. So that's at Appendix 1797, paragraph 114. That evidence was credited by the board at Appendix 49. And this is all a factual issue under Blue Calypso and supporting expert testimony. And a direct link like that within the reference is more than substantial evidence to affirm. And this is even under Novozymes' own construction.
What about obviousness in claims 8 and 9?
Yeah, the same is true for obviousness. The claim construction really doesn't matter here. The obviousness combination for claims 8 and 9 clearly teaches the same features Novozymes seeks to read into the claims. For example, with W895, it discloses jet cooking starch and completely gelatinizing the starch before you start liquefaction. And then in liquefaction, W0179 instructs one to use alpha amylase and protease simultaneously to treat liquefied mash during liquefaction. This is all in the petition at Appendix 157, 158, and Dr. Clark's testimony at 944 and accepted by the board at page 69. And Novozymes even conceded in its reply brief in this court at page 8 that it's a proper way to claim that to carry out the claimed invention either.
Just to be clear, it has to be prior to step A, right? It has to be prior. Okay.
Yeah, and that's what W0895 discloses. It even has a figure 1 with a jet cooking box before liquefaction. So you've completely finished gelatinizing the starch, and then you go into liquefaction. And on page 8 of their brief, they say if you do it that way, you can even use low temperatures in liquefaction. Do you have any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
I'll try to be efficient. There are a few things that we just heard which need to be fixed. First, if you look at Appendix 50, the board itself recognizes that the protease used in 179 is only active up to 70 degrees. There's no dispute that those proteases won't live until the second step of 179. Second thing you heard was that a lot of emphasis on the word liquefaction, sufficient liquefaction. I'll point you to A1021, A22 is the 179 disclosure. And what that does is says explicitly that the liquefaction step includes preparation of the slurry and then some initial steps before you move into the step where you then liquefy the slurry. That's broader than the meaning in our patent, which says liquefaction is the process of alpha amylase hydrolysis of the starch. So you can say it as many times as you want, liquefaction or sufficient liquefaction. It's a different thing than what is in our patent. On the claim construction point, one other small point, the last thing you heard was the rearrangement of the board's obviousness conclusion. If you look at the board's decision, what the board found for obviousness of claims 8 and 9 was that you would start with a 179 slurry, which has a protease in it, and then you would add the jet cooking step to that. So that's what the board found. If their position is different, then that's not what the board found. Finally, the one thing to take away from claim construction is that it is very clear that the intrinsic evidence and the claim language distinguishes the slurry from the liquefied mash. One turns into the other. The claim language says liquefied, or the slurry is milled grains and water. The liquefied mash in the claims is what is produced when you liquefy the slurry. That's the same thing it says in the specification. The board found that the slurry transitions into the liquefied mash. It said it goes through a different way of getting there, but the thing to take away from it is that it recognized that it is a transition. It may take time, but in that transition recognition aligns with the intrinsic evidence that they're different. All right.
Time has expired. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.